We want to do kind of a potpourri of all that we've talked about this weekend, but mostly talk about the hopefulness of where to go, what to do. Because we're truly existing in a transforming world, and that, you know, those who choose to hang on to the fantasies of the old will die. And, you know, that's sad, but it's also a very sad reality that that's the way life is presenting itself to us, that what we are needing is the ability to move into a new realm. You know, we place a lot of value in this culture on blood relations, wanting to hang on to mom and dad and the kids, wanting to hang on to those kinds of connections and contacts. And the sad reality with all of the dysfunction and the abuse and the ignorance and the denial that exists in our culture, that it becomes a self-perpetuating loss of life, of spirit, of community, because so many of our blood relatives stay in ignorance, stay in their dysfunction, stay in their pain. And so it becomes almost impossible. As you seek and search and journey through your life to be able to really acknowledge what you have gained and learned, there are not that many people, although the numbers are growing. Not that many people within individual families who seek this kind of a recovery process, thank you, or who seek this kind of awareness and healing. And then the biggest gift that I want to offer to you is to not try to take this home and teach somebody else, but to take it in when you go home and reflect it for yourself. Because that's one of our realities, is that we get excited about something, we learn new things, and immediately one of the ways that we discount ourselves is to want to go home and to give it away. Okay? We want to go home and teach former spouses, children, friends. And that is not the way. You know, the way of healthy living is that I take this home and I meditate and I become aware of what it is I need for me. And then what I do is I transform my being. And the way that I give it away is I learn to model a new being. I learn to model a being that is clear and in touch with myself and my feelings and my boundaries. A being that is able to be assertive, knows what he or she wants, asks for what he or she needs, feels confident to say no when you feel violated or intruded upon, is able to detach from other people's behavior so that when you experience conflict or things that are against your values or different from your values, that you are able to respond to the behavior but still show dignity for yourself and for the other person that you encounter, that you don't take on responsibility for other people's behavior or other people's choices in life. See, and those are statements of power. And when it talks about, in Scripture, you know, be compassionate as your Father in heaven is compassionate, it's understanding that Jesus, more than the words, you know, we tend to get preoccupied with the words because Jesus was a great teacher. But a lot of what Jesus did made sense only after people were able to understand that he lived his message. And as you really read closely in Scripture, what you find out is that most of the time he upset everybody. He upset everybody because they assumed and expected him to live by the norms or the social standards of the day, and he wouldn't do that. Because in his own wisdom, he understood the inequities, the injustice, the insanity of the behaviors of the day. So they wanted a God that came down and somehow miraculously would never die. A God that not only would never die, but would able to rise up in power and smite the enemy, whoever that enemy might be. They wanted a God that would be able to teach them and perform miracles, and Jesus wouldn't do that. He came into the world impoverished. He lived a life of humility. He didn't take a major role of leadership as it was understood in the community. He chose to be humble. He chose to meditate and pray and live by his way, not by the way of others. He chose to be assertive and clear and challenge the beliefs of the day. And that's real important for us to consider. Because a part of what happens in this transformation is that you become a prophet. And that's real important for understand that you are a prophet. You are a teacher of the way. You know, and what that means is when you are given a gift, you now have a new responsibility with that gift. And it'll be real easy to go out of Holden and go back, and within a week or so, you can go out with a glow or with a learning or with some new revitalization. But it's real easy that when you go out and go back to get lost into the world because of its busyness, its preoccupations, because you're back into familiar surroundings and just get lost in all of that. And hang on to Holden as a fond memory or some lessons. Rather, if you are to be a prophet, it means that you go back and do it differently. It means that you take time to meditate your feelings, your grief, to think about your choices, what it is you can do, how you want to be different. It means you have the courage to act differently. And know that it's probably going to upset a lot of people. Because if they're used to having you one way, if they're used to hooking you into their arguments, they're used to being able to get you upset easily, if they're used to manipulating you or getting you to do things that they need to do for themselves for you, they'll be upset when you become different. They'll be upset when you're assertive and clear and powerful. That's all right. That's their lesson to learn so they can go through their grief process. It's important that you take this on and allow it to become a transformed spirit for you. You know, you have a right to life and a right to a new way. Again, sad to say that all the prophets in Scripture were killed. So as to say that this is not an easy task. And that the common folk don't like to hear their limitations or the arrogance or the ignorance. So we need to be common, but be common in a different way. And that becomes our responsibility. And that directly relates to our being able to be with our children. See, because what becomes hope for the children is your serenity. When you become stable and clear, when you are aware of your feelings, when you are clearly able to articulate yourself and your being, then your children, no matter how much they go insane and crazy, trying to manipulate you, trying to seduce you, trying to run away from you, it's like they run, but they'll come back. See, they're running and they're separating from you. That's their job. That's their responsibility. It's a parent's responsibility to teach a child how to go away. And it's a child's responsibility to grow up and go away. Okay. So that your relationship from parent-child can ultimately be transformed into a relationship of adult to adult, or person to person. That you can transform authority to friendship. It says in John's Gospel, Jesus says, I have made known to you everything that my Father has made known to me, so my joy may be yours and your joy may be complete. I no longer call you slaves, for a slave does not know what his master is about. Instead, I call you friends. Jesus invites us through his incarnation and teaching to become as one with him. No longer to say, well, I'm God and you're all of these poor, miserable, ignorant creatures down here. But rather, Jesus says, you have the power to do things greater than I. So Jesus is giving us a huge invitation to become the sons and daughters of God. And it's that kind of modeling and that kind of generosity that God is willing to allow us to become God. That God even invites us to become God. And ultimately that's our biggest journey, is to come back to the Father and Mother, you know, to be in that light. And that really is the exemplary model for us as parents. That we may start in a role of dominance where our children are dependent. But we ask them and we teach them to grow into a new level of relationship, a level of interdependence, a level of equality, of mutual respect and mutual regard. And the way that our children learn that reality is for us to be able to model what that means for them. So it begins with you, and it begins with how you choose to be different, how you choose to take this information, the sharing, you know, the ritual, the what we've experienced this weekend, and take it into yourself to transform your being. And that when you live your being becomes an invitation. And understand that your children, being children, are going to fight you tooth and nail. And if you can transform yourself and understand that role, then you might be able to do it with a sense of humor instead of with a sense of terror. You can let the kids be kids and let them be teenagers and they're teenagers and let them be chaotic and out of control and challenging and trying and exploring. And when they experience their sadness or they experience their terror or fear or they experience their anger or their upset, see, if you are clear for you, then when they are ready to learn a lesson, then you are the one they will return to. And that's real important for you to understand. You will go through times and lots of hard times, but if you are able to remain honest and true to you, share your grief, and that means, it doesn't mean that I'm sitting there as a rock and I'm always peaceful and calm. Sometimes I'm pissed as hell. And sometimes I'm scared for them, and I share their scare, but I still let them take responsibility. You know, and other times I feel sad of choices that they make for themselves. But if I can be clear on my boundaries and responsibilities, then they know that there's a safe place in the universe to come to. And even though they may spend years, especially in their adolescence, running away from me, they run away from you only because they have the security of knowing when they need to come back that you're there. So it starts with you and with your power. Now, there are a couple concepts that I want to share with you this morning about transformation and change in our culture. And these concepts, I think, are ways to help us transform our thinking and look for new possibilities. The first one is to look at the word community as opposed to marriage. Community means unity with, means a deep sense of belonging, a deep sense of intimacy, where there is compassion and closeness, friendship, the ability to listen and be heard, to know that I am connected or I am in unity with. And that is our deepest craving. Marriage, especially in the nuclear family, where the family has been so intact and been such a primary focus as a unit, marriage has been mistaken many times for community. That what we have done in our tradition and in our past by romanticizing marriage and love and romantic love and falling in love and finding a partner is that we have taken our larger need, which is to belong and to live in community, and we have tried to find a person to put all of that need and focus into, which then puts a heavy burden on marriage and makes it almost impossible in our culture for marriage to survive. One, because of the nuclear family structure, so many married couples, once they become married, become very isolated. That they tend to keep all of their own stuff. You know, you don't air your dirty laundry. You don't talk about your things. You keep up your image. You want to, you know, be concerned about looking like the Joneses. And so when you go out into public, you're trying to manage or maintain an image, which is really a sad reality. Because the whole intent of marriage ritual in a community is not only that the couple is making a vow for one another within community, but also the reality that the community is making a vow to the couple in return. And that a healthy marriage is a marriage that needs a community. Because a man and a woman are not capable of providing for each other all of their needs of belonging. That the marriage contract is a contract of intense intimacy and commitment that has its privileges, and that's what we all seek for, wanting those privileges. But it also has tremendous responsibilities, tremendous burdens that are very, very difficult. And we set boundaries and limitations on fidelity, and we turn away from other wants and needs or freedoms or choices that we have in that marriage bond. So there is a great need for married people, that they live in community first. And they find a community that is vital to their wants and needs. The second sad characteristic of marriage is that rather than allowing community and friendship and intimacy being the basis of their relationship and commitment, in our culture we tend to romanticize and sexualize So for many of us, it was the romantic attractions and the sexual excitement that were the drawing factors in creating this relationship. So when we get into playing the dating game with one another and all of this concept of romantic love, and use that as the basis of commitment, and we make the commitment, and then we think, well, we'll learn all the other stuff later. You know, we'll evolve into a level of trust, or to a level of communication, or a level of friendship. And that's very, very sad, because the reality is, once I make the commitment of marriage, the obligations and responsibilities and burdens come so quickly that it is very, very difficult for a couple to learn the art of friendship and intimacy and ultimately a trust. Because marriage is not a phenomenon that once I make the contract goes on forever and ever, even though we say the words till death do us part. That's an ideal. The reality is marriage is a relationship that needs to be created on a daily basis. Each day you learn something new, and you change, and you become different. So there's a tremendous burden on marriage. One, because the tradition, the way that we teach marriage, is unhealthy. When you teach marriage based on the illusion of romantic love, there's such... you are set up to fail. You are set up for major conflict. Rather, what you need is trust and intimacy, friendship, and then you make the decision whether you add the romantic dimension. Because even sex in a marriage loses its romance after a period of time, and it takes on a wholly different function in a relationship. If you hang on to the illusion of romantic love, then you will die, or the relationship will be a source of dissatisfaction or disappointment. So with single parent families, the focus then is to look for community. To look for a community of compassion. Now, there are a variety of different ways that you can find a community of compassion. Sometimes it's at adventures like this, where I go to a place where, you know, I'm there because of a common reality. It's labeled a single parent retreat for something that is familiar to me. And so I'm able to be with people of like resources. You know, and we mentioned several of the other things about, like, Divorce Lifeline is a place that has resources in the community as well as counseling in the community. Tough Love groups, if it's focusing on parenting, or there are a variety of different places. Usually if you check, through in the western side of the state, through children's hospitals, if you have children's hospitals, they have a resource center of where there are agencies. Also, in the community colleges or vocational schools, there is often a lot of resource for early childhood development, parent training programs. There are the PET, parent effectiveness training groups. And there are teachers in the community. Sometimes a lot of churches will go through programs like that. Finding support groups, support community. I believe that it's important that we allow ourselves to acknowledge and be a part of a community that offers us support that offers us a spiritual connection. Support, when we talk about support, and this is a part of what's being redefined in our culture as understanding the redefinition of family. That family is moving from blood-related family to spirit-related family. My ability to make connections with people who believe as I believe, who love as I love, who are willing to share the resources. And especially when you deal with separation or divorce or single parenting, it is impossible for you to take on all of the responsibility of both parents. You cannot survive as a person first. You have to remain intact. So it's important to be able to research and look for resources and alternatives. A community that offers, whether it's daycare, or a community that offers a shared parenting, places where I can know that my child will be safe. You know, where we can farm the kids out for a while to get a break, like Lucy was talking about. Got our kids all over the place. kid. It's real important that we begin to look for those kinds of resources in our life. If we can find them in a spiritual community, that becomes valuable. But the other side is the redefining of the concept of neighborhood. Extending the concept of neighborhood to not just necessarily be neighborhood in the context of who's next door, but neighborhood in the context of who do I know and who do I value and who do I trust. So it means that some support groups may be groups that are centered and focused around your own particular need. And that's a part of the grassroots movement, I believe, in our cultures. As the institutions of the past are crumbling or dying, what you are finding is that there are all kinds of grassroots organizations that are beginning to evolve and develop, ways that people clamor for the need for community, and so what they do is they draw each other together. And there are some healthy church communities out there that, you know, have their pulse on the need of society. And so in many churches, there is the evolution of lots of different kinds of support groups. So there are ways that people get together. In this world of process and family and disease and addiction, when I talked the other day about all those compulsive behaviors, well, there are support groups for compulsive behaviors all over the place. I know in our area there's a Families Anonymous. Even in our agency we have a Families Anonymous. There's a, you know, the 12-step program, there's Parents Anonymous, there's Families Anonymous. You know, places where individuals can go to simply talk about their reality in an anonymous, healthy setting. And what we find happens in those groups is that those groups don't go there just to do that, but those groups ultimately go out to coffee together, they exchange phone numbers together, and they begin to evolve and to develop a new sense of community, a new sense of belonging, and a new sense of hope. And one of the advantages of those kind of communities, and this is part of what's real important, is because a community provides a level of intimacy. And intimacy is about depth and awareness of sharing. So when you get into particular support communities, what you are asking for and what you generally receive is a way to allow an intimacy, something you wouldn't go to the local mall and walk up to a stranger and tell. It's a place that's designed for me to come and to share on a level that's generally not available to me in my normal daily routine or in the life that I lead. And what becomes important to this is that, because this is where these two concepts get confused. It's very sad in our culture that in the dating game, in the trying to find a singular person, is that there's a lot of pressure between assuming in a one-on-one relationship that if I'm to be intimate, I'm to be sexual. Okay? But what you were able to find, and remember we talked about boundaries, learning how to bracket, what you can find in many support communities is a means and manner of being intimate, of being able to get very deep personal needs met without their having to sexualize. And that's one of the difficulties in marriage, because marriage in our culture, you know, is especially in the old biased, ignorant, traditional ways that we teach sexuality, is that sex is something that you keep quiet and you keep private, and that you keep it only for your relationship. And because of our denial and ignorance about being sexual beings, what literally happens is that when people get into marriage, at least initially into marriage, they tend to focus on this aspect of the relationship and not develop this side of the relationship. You know? And if your horniness is the way that you choose relationships, you know, it becomes very, very difficult. And unfortunately, when you're out there, if you're looking for alternatives in marriage, you know, if it's real sad that bars and taverns become the primary social way that we meet people. And when you go out into bars and taverns, what you find is a highly sexualized reality, because that's where what people do. When the music is that loud and the lights are flashing and you're into an altered state of being, you know, it becomes kind of a pickup game. So it's very hard to find any of this kind of reality out in the social structures that are focused or functioned on sexualizing relationships. So look for the resources. Places where you can find support. Places that might involve a spiritual value. Something that is connected to your being. Places that allow you an intimacy with boundaries, where you are not threatened for your being, or not threatened for your body, or not obligated or responsible to have to compromise your need and dignity. When you go through grief and loss, especially of a relationship, the grief period is generally a 2 to 4 year process. In other words, to come out of a major relationship, there is a time of numbness, a time of going through the intensity and the agony of the grief and loss, and then there is a time of learning to be in the world differently, transforming myself, to relearn relationships and change values. And it's real important that you allow yourself the patience to walk through that process. And that's one of the biggest obsessions of our culture, is that we are so into instant cure that when we lose one relationship, we become real preoccupied and desperate for another. And we don't walk through the grief, and so what happens is we simply recycle the old values and old attitudes and old behaviors and old beliefs, because we haven't allowed ourselves time to be transformed, to learn the lessons of grief and loss inside of ourselves. So the seeking of community, of intimacy, of closeness. I know there are lots of, because of the codependency phenomenon that's become so large in the adult children of alcoholics, there are lots of church communities that do groups for, like, women who love too much. When Robin Norwood's book came out, that became a real popular grouping of people. One of the things that I'm aware of we do at our agency, but that's evolving more and more, is groups for men's issues. Nick, we have men's intimacy groups, and we're getting such a big response now that we're thinking of opening a second men's intimacy group, because our first one has been full for a long time. And what we're finding is that where traditionally many of the therapy groups that we had evolved in our agency were about 85 to 90% female, now what we're finding is more and more men. Last summer, we had the very first group that out of 12 people, there were 8 men and 4 women. And that's the first group of that sort that dealt with family of origin and emotional issues that was dominated by men. So we're finding that men are more and more coming to seek and to say, I'm lost and I need some, you know, I need support for me too. So there are new groups evolving, men's issues groups, sometimes turning to the community colleges or to the vocational schools. Those are places where many times they will put together classes or issue around those kinds of issues, and that becomes at least a resource or a starting place to continue to go educate and to at least acknowledge some of those issues and values for myself. So there are lots of resources out there. There's also places, in the alcoholism chemical dependency field, there are places like 24-hour helpline, and in the Pierce County area there's an organization called CARE that are information resource places. Crisis Line also has a lot of resource in terms of understanding what are the different community resources available to us. In terms of child care, there's not a whole lot. There are some of the different agencies out there that are specific to the significant problems. So what I'm talking about is like there's Child Study and Guidance Center, which is a place that does a lot of research with children, but usually the clients that they take in are clients of major abuse or some kind of major family or psychological dysfunction. The chronic runaway or the child that's created some kind of criminal act or shown some kind of major crisis for themselves. There are beginning to be different agencies, and what's beginning to evolve now in the schools, in the school districts, is that our school districts are now hiring personnel to identify high-risk students. They're doing self-help groups in the school district, like natural helpers for kids who are chemically dependent. The schools are becoming more and more aware of the need for support for young children, and so they're at least beginning to network. And I know I go out and do lots of training in different school districts to teach them about community resources. So sometimes getting a hold of the guidance center and trying to find somebody who's knowledgeable or finding if there's support. Because school, after the age of 5, becomes another primary socialization process. So whatever you can do to be involved with schools is real important, at least to find out what's available resource-wise, because there are grants being written left and right, and lots of new resources evolving through the different schools. Now I'm going to move to a different track, so I want to stop and ask, do you have questions or responses to what
I just want to say, I felt real validated to hear about the community. Just recently I've been real, and my friends, like, I don't have time today for a primary intimate relationship, and when I think about that, I'm not willing to give up the community I'm developing today. I'm not willing to leave that behind, and I'm trying to stay one day at a time and not worry about how I'm going to get there. I mean, if I'm going to have an intimate relationship, the way will be shown, but just felt real validated that is, and that's okay for me, that really is important. So I appreciate hearing that.
I found for a while that my primary community was the church, but I had to rid myself of unreal expectations of what the church should be for me in the midst of my pain, which was a lot of silence from the pastor on down. So I left the church for a while and was without community, began to realize that the essence of community was there and that I needed to shed some of my own feelings of what they should be, and then go back and just weave myself back into that community.
Mm-hmm. And we have to understand that church is a humanly created organization. So any religious community has the same failings that we as human beings have. And that, and I think your statement is real accurate, that we often have expectations of that community that are unrealistic. We assume them to be benevolently compassionate and able to respond to all our needs, when in fact that the community itself may be ignorant. And there may be, and this is a kind of the scriptural text for this that I think of is like the loaves and the fishes, that there may be nothing within the structure of the community, but it may be because nobody has ever decided to share and to give rise to. And when somebody takes the risk and put it out there, there may be lots of compassion and lots of willingness within the community to support the needs that I have. It's just that it has never been spoken in the community, and so the community has remained stuck or limited. You know, there's kind of two things, that I have a responsibility back to the community to challenge that community to listen to me and to what it is that I need. Then there's also the scriptural passage of that there comes a time when you need to shake the dust from your sandals. And when you get a community that refuses to hear and cannot respond, then it's time to kind of shake it all off and head on down the road and seek out and know. The idea is that in our traditional intellectual expectation, we tend to be very black and white, and we don't see lots of areas of gray, that there are lots of choices and resources, and that part of what behooves us, it's the kind of the same thing that happens in marriage relationships, is that couples get so stuck in conflict and they become very black and white, where it becomes a win-lose situation, which means for the marriage it's a losing situation. I can share with you for years as a marriage therapist that when couples would come in for counseling, it was usually the two of them sitting there, each telling their own story and looking at me and saying, which one's right? And what I could, you know, I think the value that I had as a therapist is that I didn't get triangulated by that. That I would not take sides and say, well, I think this, you know, this one's probably right and you need to change your way. But rather I would look back and say, there's a greater problem in all of this. That each from your own want and need perspective has a value in what you have to say, but what you are functioning on is limited perception. What you are functioning on is the inability to see that from your own point of views, each of you has a valid point and a valid grief and there is a valid conflict. And the need for you as a couple is to enhance your vision, enhance your resources, and enhance your skills. But the other part of that is to also know that getting new vision, getting relief, and getting new skills doesn't mean that the marriage is going to work. Sometimes it simply means that we recognize more clearly the mistake that we've made with one another. We see things that we were blind and ignorant to when we entered into our commitment. See, because nobody goes into a marriage ceremony recognizing that, well, we're probably being real ignorant, stupid, and we're going to get divorced someday. You know, we enter into it with that full intent of commitment, you know, of really wanting the desire. But we also need to have compassion and acknowledge that when we made that commitment, there may be lots of aspects of our history, or lots of aspects of our family or our belief systems that have not been exposed, that are a severe detriment to us. And that when you do and see those things, the more loving thing to do is to acknowledge them and to let go, rather than trying to hang on to something and trying to survive an idealistic obligation at the expense of my dignity, respect, and value as a person. So I think what you say is valid, that you need to let go of the expectations of church. And sometimes it means when I feel ignored or rejected by a community, I have to ask myself first, am I responsible for that neglect because I have isolated, or I have been passive, or I haven't even gone and asked for what I needed, or the people that I go to or the people that I know can't support me? You know, if you have made yourself known and there is nobody there to hear you, you know, then it's time to move. Any other comments or questions? I just spaced out in here. I forgot the other track that I was going to go off on. Hang on here. Yeah. Kind of went to bed at night. Huh? Yeah, it's the best session. Yeah, that's right. Humility. The other track there is going to move us on. I did remember. Is dealing with the other parent, or parents, or other community. That when there is a divorce, separation, widowhood, or loss that begins to happen, that part of the grief process has to do, and what grieving is about, is that I lose a part of myself. My grief is for me, it's not for other people. And so what often happens is that when we become part of a marriage unit or a community unit, and just as Ellie is sharing, that I come into that community with a certain set of values and expectations. And what literally happens is when a marriage breaks down or changes, or a community breaks down and changes, what happens to me is that I go into what's called a value confusion. Meaning things that I have counted on as structure or boundaries or values or important resources, places where I had assumed that I would be able to get certain needs met, places that I had assumed that there would be things that I could count on being taken care of, or that I put myself into a role. So another part of this is identity confusion. And so part of the initial stages of grief, when we are in our denial and we're numbness, one of the things that we tend to do is to try to be all things to our children. One of the things that we try to do is try to maintain the same family life with one absentee parent. We try to function as if there's the same amount of money. We want the kids to buy or have the things that they've had before when there was a two-parent family together. We want to do all of the external things in the community when there were two parents available. And so a lot of those ways that we get stuck in denial, in our rage, and in our depression, is that we are trying to, even though we may be physically separated, that a part of us denies the reality and wants to hang on to that we can function the same way, we're just without the other person there. And it becomes a human impossibility. Becomes a setup for inadequacy and failure. That change means change. Oftentimes what we're trying to do is to protect our children. Well, of course, Daddy still loves you, or of course, Mommy still loves you. when the reality can be is that there's a change and relationships are going to change and the children need to grieve. There are several books out that are excellent books about the children of divorce or the children of widowhood. Okay, and it's real important for people to understand that children grieve right along with us. And we need to not interfere with their right to grieve. Trying to present and to hang on to illusions like mommy or daddy still loves you, or there's going to, you know, that things are going to be the same, is a way that we truly set ourselves up and we set the children up for guilt and for shame. One of the times, and why I thought it was real important to mention this, is that one of the times that becomes the most difficult struggle in separation and divorce is holidays and special occasions. Because where grief tends to show itself most is where there has been ritual, where we have had a tradition of some sort. And suddenly we enter this time of holiday seasons and we are single or we are separate and there is going to be pressure and conflict about who gets the kids when and how do we go about doing our rituals. And there's our own personal loss and grief about, you know, if I've spent years looking forward to the holiday season, you know, with my ideal of family, and suddenly there is no family, or there is less family, then oftentimes what holiday seasons or special occasions mean is that we find ourselves getting into a deep depression because of having to redefine, because we experience our grief and loss more intently during those times. So it's important for you to acknowledge first your grief and loss. Grieve for yourself. It's okay to have an isolated time and be angry and furious, even though you understand that separating or being divorced was important and a healthy decision for you. It's important to also recognize that in being married, that not everything that we did together was bad, that there were lots of things that we valued, things that were important to us. And while the conflicts of the marriage or the relationship became so difficult that it was reasonable for us to get out of the relationship, we still need to grieve the loss of the things that we valued. A lot of the things that we valued in the relationship were things that we liked. See, we may not like our partner, but we may like the idea of having a partner. We may have liked being a wife, or we may have liked being a parent, or we may have liked spending lots of time and having the freedom to spend lots of time doing chores or responsibilities or jobs that are family related. And so it's important for us to grieve the loss. Grieve the loss of what you value. Or what you had valued in the relationship. In the intensity of divorce or separation, we're always preoccupied with what's wrong with the relationship. And we tend to put on the back burner the things that we value or were good for us in the relationship. And that's why in the holiday seasons, because so many of us value the holiday seasons, the things that we have lost, the things that were good, that got lost in all the conflict and all of that stuff comes back to us. And then what generally happens is part of our value confusion is we go into self-doubt, start second-guessing ourselves and saying, well, maybe it wasn't so bad. You know, and look what I did, I cut myself off. And those things are not lost. That experience and that choice with that partner is lost. But there are things that you can do for you. And what's important is that you define that if you learn to acknowledge the grief of a ritual or a situation or an important tradition for yourself, that you can transform that grief into a healthy new tradition. Okay. Part of the transformation is that I have to go through my loss in order for me to transform and create a new tradition. So I'm literally transforming traditions by going through the same loss and grief process. What that means is to take the value that I have, but also put it in, and part of the transforming is putting it into a healthy, realistic perspective that I have to put boundaries. That when I am dealing with an absentee parent, there is the reality of sharing the children, meaning that you may not have the kids on the particular holiday, like Christmas is often a real difficult time for separated parents. If both parents have a value around Christmas, there is a way that it always is a conflict because there's only one Christmas morning. So if you have traditions, it becomes a real difficult way of discernment. So it's important for you to know, what can you do? How can you value that? An example for us, it was very difficult for my wife to, because she has such a strong value of traditions and family being together. But ultimately what we've worked out, and it's been, and we had a workable, her ex-spouse, that we have our Christmas on Christmas Eve day. So that we go through our tradition, and then we go to the early, the early Mass or liturgy, and then after that Mass, then we transport the children that they spend Christmas Day with their dad, the two older children. And that it was a way at first that grew out of a lot of pain and conflict, but ultimately we had to do the process of negotiation. And when the children were able to acknowledge that, and eventually what happened for the kids is that they were able to grieve that and they felt a little torn. But eventually what happens is when it becomes a tradition and you place your family value in it, the kids begin to look at the positive side of it. So for our two older kids, it was like, well, I get my stuff a day before everybody else in the neighborhood gets their stuff. So they're okay with that. Or I get twice as much stuff because I got two families to go to. There are advantages for young people. It's also being able to say with them, my financial resources are not the same, as your dad's resources or as your mom's resources. And so it's important that you sit down and dialogue with the children, that when you make your tradition, that you make your tradition based on what your value is, and not get into a competitiveness of I've got to buy as good or as much as the ex is going to do for the kids. But rather what will happen is that when I can get into a consistency and a ritual and tradition that is meaningful and valuable for me, then what happens for the young people is that they begin to acknowledge that value, especially if it's something that you invite them to. They acknowledge that value and they look forward to it. Again, I'd share a personal example. One of the things that we do around Thanksgiving time is that, St. Leo's, the parish that we belong to, puts on a big feast for the poor. So what we do on Thanksgiving Day is all go down to St. Leo's and we spend 2 or 3 hours just working in the kitchen or serving food or And so it's become like a ritual because we've been doing it for several years. So even if the kids go off to their dad's, the older kids go off to their dad's house, when they come back, they always ask us, well, how was it down there? Did you see so-and-so? See, in the back of their mind, they know that that's a value. And if it's something that they value with you, even if they're not there, they want to stay connected to it. Devising your traditions and rituals for you. Again, the compulsivenesses of our society is we tend to be real competitive and use things as a way to express our love. And understand that ritual and tradition is not things. Ritual and tradition is, what do we do in the Advent season? What do we do in the preparation? You know, my youngest is driving me absolutely bonkers now. I shared with you before about his wanting to do pumpkins on October 1st, and he's already bugging me about Christmas lights. And but the point is that for him, he just absolutely loves. He's already digging out the Christmas records, and you know, because for him, memories, tradition, and ritual is about remembering. See, that's what the whole Christian tradition is about, is about remembering. You know, when you eat this bread, remember me. When you drink this cup, remember me. Remember means to remember, to bring alive again. So we invite Christ into our midst whenever we do the Eucharistic ritual. We celebrate the memory of that Last Supper. And that's what our traditions can be, is defining for ourselves what's essential and important, and allowing ourselves to go through the preparations and inviting the children, but again having to set boundaries and limits. Utilizing the gift of the time that we do have. Where most people get depressed and stuck, especially in the holiday seasons, is they want to hang on to the old vision. So I'm going to fight my spouse, you know, for I want it on this day in this way. And that particular day in that particular way doesn't mean a lot to your child. Especially if it's a day in a way that's filled with rage and anger and upset and depression and conflict. No child is going to value that. And they're just going to shy away from it, feel guilty about it. So these become real important times and real important ways. And know that there are lots of things. It's not black and white. It's not who has our kid on which particular day. It's more, what do I do with my child when my child is with me? It's not combating and getting into a conflict over, dad says you're, or mom says you're, and trying to justify to our children what the other parent may be telling them from their perspective and their reality. When you validate to know who you are in your being, in your life, then just live your traditions and live your life from your own humility and let your life speak for itself. That's a personal lesson that we have learned for years, because I know my ex-wife was really frightened because of the amount of money that her ex-husband would generate. And she was real frightened that the children would alienate their affection. And I was separate from that, so it was easier for me to be somewhat detached from that and be able to say, you know, I know his illusion and his lies and his manipulations. Don't try to enter into the kids, because, of course, when he would promise them the world, they were all wanting to, well, if you're not going to give me what I want, my dad will. And I just said, let him bury himself. And it's taken a long time, but 8 years later, 10 years later now, all of those things have become true. That it was not entering into a combat with a former spouse about who is right or wrong or good or bad. It's let the children experience their own affections or their own traditions, but also let them experience their own grief and pain. Stay centered and focused on what is essential for you in your life and value. And if you are true to you, then they will value your presence and they will value your being. If you find yourself preoccupied with trying to compete, or if you find yourself worried about how the ex-spouse may be better, that's a huge discount to you. It's a huge discount to your love, to your spirit, and to the bond that exists between you and your children. Focusing on them is wasted energy. You have enough to deal with your own grief and to work out the business arrangements of having to somehow stay connected. You know, shuffling them back and forth and sharing of resources, whether that's child support or whatever, financial obligations, transportation, decision making about, you know, primary needs, medical needs, clothing needs, whatever those things are. There's enough energy that you need to spend with that rather than being concerned about what happens to the children when they're with them. If you are clear and open, then the children will trust and they will communicate and they will tell you what they feel and they will ask you what you feel. And if you are consistent, they will be satisfied and they will make their own decisions. Children are not stupid. We have a tendency to think in our overprotective society that children don't know what's going on and they are not clear about their own feelings and that they don't know what their own wants and needs are. And they're profoundly insightful. Matter of fact, children haven't learned the sophisticated mechanisms of denial like adults do. One of my favorite stories is about family that came in, a dad who went into treatment for alcoholism, and we had a family group, and a lot of the people were there, and we asked the wife about why she was there and what did she see the problem in the family was, and she says, well, it's all a surprise to me. I know that he drank a little bit, but I didn't see that it was that big a deal. And then we turned and asked the teenager, well, what's your vision of what's wrong with the family? And he says, oh, well, Dad drinks too much and he gets, he gets pretty angry sometimes. But I don't know why he's in treatment. And then we turned to the 5-year-old and says, what do you think of your family? And he said, and this little 5-year-old says, when I grow up, I want to be a drunken truck driver like my dad and beat my wife. See, children don't know the sophisticated ways to minimize and deny reality. They just say it like it is. They know what's there. And oftentimes, you know, when we have families in, the children give us the best information, because they give us the clearest information. They don't know how to hide it. And so what happens for us as parents, the worst thing that we can do is try to hide reality from them, because they know reality probably better than we do. So it's important to invite them into communicating, invite them into sharing their feelings, affirm and validate their right to feel their feelings. Invite them into the awareness of understanding that when there is divorce or separation or when we are in single parenting, that our reality as family is changing. And you have a right to be mad and you have a right to be scared and sad about those realities. And so invite them to walk through their grief so that they can transform. They don't have to like living as a single parent family because they're going to be required to probably sacrifice a lot. And there won't be a lot of the freedoms and the resources and the privileges that maybe they had when there was a two-parent family. And it's okay for them to be mad about that. And it's okay for them to be mad and for you not to be guilty about it. That they're just feeling their feeling. But when they can feel their feelings, then they can go on with the reality of this is the way it is, and what can we do to establish our traditions, what we need for us, so that we can stay healthy and together and alive. And the other part that often happens is, especially if the children are a little bit older, is that it's important for you to understand that your grieving process and a child's grieving process can be different. So you may be accepting things and moving on, and they may not. They may choose to be angry for a long, long time. And they may choose to be angry at you, that they want to, that they don't want to give up their illusions. And one of the ways that children tend to do that is to use one parent against the other. One of the ways that you can combat that is to recognize that if they choose to hang on to their illusion, you give it back to them, that that's their illusion, and you let them go huffing off in their own grief from their own illusions, and you don't buy into it. Because one of the ways that they tend to do that is to try to, you know, they try to triangulate you, play one parent against the other. So when they don't like your new traditions and your new boundaries and your new limits, what they're going to do is threaten you with, well, I want to go live with Dad, or I want to go live with Mom. And for you to be able to say, if that's a reality, you know, it can be a reality. Are you ready to be able to let go of your children if you need to, if it becomes too abusive and too painful for you? Or are you clear enough to be able to set the boundaries and say that's not an option or a choice for you? And if you want to do it, I'm not going to help you. You'll have to find your own way. And let them walk out the door and let them find out realities. Because most of their grieving and most of their threats are veiled threats. And are you willing to let them go out and experience their own consequences? These are hard questions about parenting. Very hard questions about parenting. Because it's another part of our grief and loss that we have to deal with when our child chooses a different path. When our child refuses to forgive us and wants to blame us for the divorce, or blame us for the separation, and chooses to want to victimize us as parents as a way of avoiding their own loss and grief. That's why it's essential that you have your support systems in your community, a place where you can go and be healthy. The final thing that I would say is to see, you know, there's a lot of stigma attached to therapy and counseling. Because the illusion of our culture, the stigma of our culture, is that's only where sick people go. Only when I'm crazy or insane do I need counseling. And the reality is that therapy is a gift. Therapy is an invitation. Therapy is a place where you can be around a highly skilled professional, be around a group of other people or in similar circumstance. And it's a gift. It's a way that I value and love myself by providing the financial resources and committing myself to saying, I need this kind of intense, intimate, safe environment where I can share the deeper grief and where I can get the nurturing and the affirmation and support that I deserve. And when you give yourself permission to say that when I am really stuck and feeling lost and out of control, if I need therapy or if I need treatment of some sort, that treatment and therapy is my gift to me, that I deserve it. I have a right to that. And eventually what happens is that it then becomes an option for your children in their stuckness. if they can see that you're willing to commit to it and that it's become a value for you, then they will see it as an alternative for them. And as they go through their struggles and face their own grief, it becomes another resource that you as parents don't have to figure it out all by yourself. That it becomes okay for you to be able to say, if this is real hard for you, or if the behavior and the conflict in the household gets too hard, it's okay to say, how about we go to a counseling group, or you go to a kids group, a place where you, because that's something, especially if you're a single parent, it becomes a real valuable option for your child to have a place where they can go to vent all of their rage and anger and do all of their grief and know that you don't have to be a part of it, that they can keep it separate, it's confidential and private. So they have a resource outside of just you as the primary adult to vent that kind of things. And that's also a healthy way, because they then can learn the difference. If they get stuck between thinking that it's only you or this other parent, but you and the other parent have all these things, they tend to just keep everything stuffed inside. But if they have a safe place to go, that they can be anonymous and to vent, it's just a wonderful experience for children. You know, I've done some of the kids groups, and it's just wonderful to when I introduce anger work to them, teach them healthy skills of how to do anger, how much they just really love to get into, they love to have one of those patakas or the little foam bats and just start beating on things and ranting and raving in a place where it's okay for them to scream and they're not going to get yelled at, and they just love having a place where they can rag for hours, and they can walk out and be free of all of that energy. So it becomes a real resource for you to know that your children deserve the same kind of community support and intimacy. And when you find a counselor or a group that has a focus that fits for you, that becomes another community resource support for you and for your children as well. So, questions, responses? We saved about 15 minutes so that we can. We want to do some. Jackie has some evaluations, but one of the things we want to do is, if there are things that haven't been brought up or things that you would like to question.
What I'd like to do is give you each an evaluation. I think it takes some time, either between now and the time you go, to fill out, or you're welcome to take it along with you if you want to give some more thought to it. But I want to take some time to just verbally process the weekend, because I think sometimes when we talk, we get stimulated by other people's ideas about how they received sort of the event. And last year, the feedback that the people who were here gave us was really helpful in planning for this year. And so, and in fact, it helped so much that it more than doubled the number who came this year. So we consider that pretty successful. And so I'd like to just kind of begin by maybe talking about the parts of the retreat that you found especially meaningful or helpful, and kind of would like to maybe see continued in the next retreat that we do for single parents.